Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Hang on a minute. Where's Slotty? He's not here again. Arthur, where's Slotty gone?
I don't know. He's been gone so long, I've virtually forgotten who he is.
Anyone seen him?
I don't know.
Well, listen, before we get started, this is an appeal from us at the Ruck. If you see a slightly off-the-wall figure, a medium height, slim build, sometimes looks like a mad professor, would you please contact Times Newspapers? Hi everyone, a new Ruck this week. Season seems to be getting bigger and bigger. And so does our panel, but only in terms of status, not weight. We've got three stellar characters this week on the panel. Stella Barnes, Stella Delalio, and Stella Lowe. Welcome to the Ruck. The Lions selections get nearer and nearer. England are the Six Nations champions, although not inspired by Eddie Jones with the men, but inspired by a really fine team led by Sarah Hunter with the women. Congratulations to them. Lawrence, I think just to wrap things up, we'll give you the final say on the somewhat bizarre process under which Eddie Jones was reviewed as England coach.
I might take a sort of line out of the PRL sort of press handbook and say I'm not prepared to say anything of any interest or any significance at all that might be important to the future development of rugby. But anyway, that's another matter, I'm sure, which we'll discuss very shortly. Yes, the review, it was interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think there's been a lot of reasons given as to why England finished fifth. One is that they made their own hotel restrictions so severe that the players found it really tough. I mean, surely you just go and change them, don't you? I mean, I'm not quite sure how you... So that's one area. You know, there was obviously some issues around coaches having to isolate. I mean, I think, you know, the single biggest issue going forward is that this is the England rugby team, and you've got to surround yourself with the very best coaches. And I think Eddie Jones and the rest of the team need to ask themselves the question, have they done that? You know, they've lost Steve Borthwick, very big detail man, and they've replaced him with Matt Proudfoot. That's not a like-for-like change in any way, shape or form. And the England forwards were off their, you know, off the mark right from the start, really. So then that needs addressing because their work at the breakdown and their line-out work has gone backwards. And I think their scrum work, even though they've replaced him with the best scrummaging coach in the world, or certainly South Africa's scrummaging coach, that's gone backwards as well. The most penalised England scrum, or the most penalised scrum in the tournament. And as for England's attack, well, let's not even get onto that because you haven't got an attack if you haven't got a full pack that can at least get parity. So I think there is still questions for me around selection. You know, we've seen an incredible round of Premiership games across the weekend, and some of the best players are nowhere near being picked for England. And there's some issues around the coaching as well. And I'm sure it's something that that hopefully will be addressed in the coming weeks.
I have to say, I agree. Sometimes it's very rare to see a Premiership game where you don't see someone who should be in the England team. Alex, you laboured absolutely heroically last week for the Times in the absence of Owen Slott and did it all yourself. Magnificent coverage, seriously. There was once a film called The Man Who Never Was. Could Darren Childs make a remake of that film? No, he's gone.
Well, yes. He was in charge for 20 months. He did one television interview. He was criticised for virtually the entire time by the clubs for his lack of communication, never mind by the media, who just tried to understand what was going on. He was the wrong appointment at the wrong time. As a man brought in from UK TV with a business background to effectively do a television deal, he was plunged into one crisis after another, Saracens, COVID. And as a lot of club owners who I and sort of club executives who I spoke to last week said, he didn't have an understanding of the rugby dynamic, the politics. And with a fair wind over the last 20 months, he might have understood it more, but he didn't have that fair wind because of the crises. And he lurched from one round of criticism to another. And he jumped last week after hearing of plans for a vote of no confidence from the clubs. So there needs to be a fresh start. I think Nigel Melville has come in on the club's behest to be an executive chairman, and they like the work he's doing. He obviously understands the rugby landscape. So the appointment of the new chief exec is critical for the direction of Premiership Rugby, which has had a really bad rap, both externally from us and internally from the clubs over the last couple of years.
Thank you. And Stuart, we're not going to ask you to go political because we'll be bringing up Jeremy Corbyn within seconds if we do. So can I just ask you this? You're always, as a former fly half yourself, a student of the great fly halves. You started off praising François Trinduc in France, the man you described as the new Barry John. You then spent a lot of time in the camp of Dan Carter. Have we got a new diamond now in the Barnes firmament with Dan Biggar? Because this weekend, you've praised him to the skies.
I praised him more for the manner in which he played than just being a fly half. I thought Biggar was heroic. I think we live in an age when people first and foremost think, what's in it for me? Even in team sports now, it's inevitable. You get paid a lot of money. You've got agents saying, think about yourself. Biggar put Northampton above anything. He was limping off. He'd taken a fair old battering. And, you know, he is in contention for the Lions. Ugo Monier said on television, if that had been me, I'd have been straight off there without thinking. It was partly joking, but there was partly an element of truth. And that's how players think. Biggar put his mates first. And we don't see that very often. He's also playing extremely well. He played outstandingly for Wales in the Six Nations. He's playing very well for Northampton. But more than anything, it was his commitment to the cause, the fact that there was something of the socialist in the way he played, Steve.
Excellent. I knew you'd get there in the end with the
put. Can I just say what, very quickly?
Yeah.
Darren Charles, has he gone to CVC?
Yeah, one of his future roles is to be an advisor for CVC, yeah.
Yes.
So this bloke, CVC, who rugby has given lots of shares to because they're brilliant and they're going to make the game lots of money and save it from itself. They're so brilliant that they have appointed Darren Charles as one of their advisors. No, I don't get that.
It leaves you a nice warm feeling, that, doesn't it?
Steve, I know you promised Lawrence the last word on that review, and you wrote a big piece on Sunday drawing parallels and connections between the RFU review and the Darren Charles departure. The one thing I'd say that connects the two, and part of it comes from the job that we all try and do, is that both organisations have developed a reputation for secrecy and a lack of transparency. That review, for example, was full of what Eddie Jones, if he worked for any other organisation, would have termed excuses. But the key element in it is that advice was taken from an anonymous panel, and that panel will now remain in place to advise and scrutinise Eddie for the next 2 years. But nobody on it was prepared for their name to be made public, which I don't think is good enough for the RFU. And one of Darren Child's biggest issues was the secrecy, this lack of communication, this lack of transparency around the organisation. And I know that there are businesses and there are confidential issues at stake, but they have to realise that this is the people's game, and they've got to bring people with them, both organisations, because the lack of transparency just builds distrust.
Well spoken. Lawrence, just put rugby on a sort of human front. Whenever someone goes down in pain this time of the season, so close to a Lions tour and to the big games, there's always a sort of everyone goes silent. This week, two great men, two great players, Joe Launchbury and George North, went down with what would look at the moment as serious injuries. I mean, that's disaster for the two clubs. You feel so sorry, don't you, for the two players?
Well, listen, I feel sorry for any player who gets injured. You know, I was at the London Irish Harlequins game. Will Evans, you know, looked like he broke his leg. I think he's had an operation, so he went off with a horrific injury. As you say, George North, I think, left the stadium in a boot, one of those cast boots, which is never a good sign. You know, it certainly won't be on the pitch anytime soon. And Joe Launchbury, who has had his own injury worries, I think has battled back magnificently, got himself in super form, you know, may or may not certainly have been in contention for a place on the Lions tour, was playing really well, Wasps talisman. And yeah, and he left the stadium on crutches and is having a scan this morning. So yeah, just one of, you know, it's terribly sad. You don't want to see any of those players injured, but particularly so close to a Lions tour. And these are the fine margins, you know, as Barnsley was talking about, Dan Bigger putting his body on the line. I think all these players do that week in, week out. You know, you just got to, Warren Gatland, I'm sure, will be crossing everything because there's still a few more weeks to go. Yes, the squad is announced, you know, on this May the 6th, but, you know, it's so important that he gets as many people fit and well on that plane to South Africa.
Sure. Stuart, another enthusiastic, well, your match report of the East Midlands Derby, very, very enthusiastic. And it is so nice for a start to see these two teams playing with the edge that they've sort of lacked. What do you make of it? And are these two teams really on their way back to the top?
Well, I think that's a bit early, Steve.
Yeah.
Was an East Midlands Derby, and I think Leicester were palpably the second best team, but because of the nature of the Derby, they found something to come again. And I think Leicester actually have got a long way to go. They're rebuilding from source. For a few years, they've had coaches who have tried to build from sand as a foundation. At least Borthwick is going back to what he knows and what Leicester knows. But they have limitations at the moment, and there's a lack of class in some areas, although I thought Mani Nandolo was fantastic when he came off the bench. As for Northampton, when Chris Boyd joined them, they were starting to play rugby like this very quickly. They then, again, they lost, and I think Lawrence will bear this out, they just forgot about the foundations of set-piece ball. And without that, you can't play. Now, you know, they shocked Leicester. They had Paul Hill, who wasn't meant to start, caused problems for a Leicester scrum who have been demolishing everyone. And I can see Northampton finding their way into the top four, not winning it this year, but becoming serious contenders next year. I love the Bigger, Hutchinson, the powerful 10, the subtle 12 combination. Proctor comes in as a very good 13. They've got a lot going for them and they're enjoying their rugby. Of course, right now, the other thing that's going for Northampton's way, they're a hard ground team, you know. They really like a fast track. And they played some poor rugby, as Bigger said, in the second half, but they defended their way to victory there. It was a really enjoyable game, I thought. It was exciting, entertaining, a little bit scrappy in parts, but overall, it was perhaps the most intense game, bar Friday night of a weekend, that was high on entertainment.
Exeter, question marks or small question marks began to arise. Lawrence, there weren't many question marks about their win over Bristol, were there?
No, there certainly weren't. I mean, Bristol had a 12-point buffer at the top of the table going into that clash. So sometimes when a team is so far in front, maybe the game lacks the bite that you'd get if it was a playoff game, obviously, or anything. But it was an outstanding game of rugby. I think it was the outstanding game of rugby at the weekend in terms of the skill and talent that was on display. And that was with both sides still missing one or two players as well. Bristol probably missing more. But Exeter were almost back to their best. I thought it'll get talked about a lot in the next couple of weeks, but the performances of Sam Simmons, of Jack Knoll, fantastic to see him back. I mean, just watching him play in that game made you realise what a quality player he is. And Slade as well. So I thought all three of them, if we're on Lions watch, produced, you know, performances that would have warmed Warren Gatland for sure. But, you know, I think it was Chris Boyd I heard say over the weekend that attack wins matches, but defence wins titles. And his team defended heroically at Leicester. And I have to say, Exeter's defence against Bristol, a team that loved to go wide, they turned them over at the breakdown. It was superbly refereed, which makes a huge difference as well, by Wayne Barnes, the best referee in the world by a country mile. And it was just a wonderful contest, you know, and I thought, you know, Exeter just had that little bit extra, really. But, I mean, it's fairly clear to me that these two teams will be, you know, if they're not competing in the Premiership final at the end of the season, then someone's caused up a major upset.
Alex, Lawrence brought up Henry Slade there, a name that doesn't figure really much in the last Six Nations because he didn't really appear to have much chance to get in the game. Is it true that some of these players are looking far more confident and far more proficient with their clubs than they ever do with England? Because Slade looked like the Slade we all know and love on Friday.
Yes, Jonesy. I mean, it's a reprise of conversations that we had through the Six Nations about Henry Slade, that England were unable to, and have actually for large parts of his international career, been unable to create an attacking situation that allows him to flourish in the way he flourishes for Exeter. The dynamic is wrong with England, particularly when Manu Tuilagi's not playing. They just can't get it. They don't have the carriers. They don't have the platform often up front. And when he's playing for Exeter, he is a supreme outside centre. I mean, he's just one of the most effective, but also just one of the most beautiful players to watch. His kicking is perfect. His lines of running, his handling is delicate and accurate. I think he's a superb player. And England had just never managed to get the best from him. And particularly when Manu's not there, you end up either with Owen Farrell or Henry Slade being asked to run direct ball carrying lines, and it wastes his talent. And it's a frustration for England because we all know what a world-class player he is.
Well, it's one of those classics that if you're not going to get the ball to him, then why pick him? It almost insults him and everyone else to suggest that the way England play, that the ball just doesn't get out to him anywhere near enough. But then again, you know, he is a senior player. You can't just sit there accumulating caps. You've got to go in there and say, guys, we've got to fundamentally change the way we play, you know. Yeah. Otherwise, what's the point in picking me?
Well, that's part of the wider conversation. How many voices are there saying this isn't working? That's a conversation we've had a lot.
Probably none. And
we'll probably continue to have.
Stuart, we're talking about Owen Farrell just there, and the fact that for the Lions, he may probably won't have Tuilagi alongside him. In a test series like that, do you not need some physical people and people who are even more physical than Farrell? And if he does go on to it, I'm sure he will. Is he only going to be contending for 10? Because against the box, don't you need a different sort of player at 12?
Are you asking me a question, Jonesy, or are you leading me to an answer?
No, you can have answer whatever you want. You may get it right or you may get it wrong.
Owen Farrell, since the World Cup semi-final, hasn't really merited playing for his country, let alone the Lions, on form. But he does have credit in the bank with Gatland. He was competitive as hell in 2017, and he was a very bright young thing coming through in 2013. So he's going to go. But frankly, how do you use him? Steve, I agree. I think with Demian Diolende lined up at 12, you have to fight fire with fire. And quite clearly, I have not even a moment's doubt with saying that Henshaw at 12 and Slade at 13 is your answer centre situation. Mm-hmm. Does Farrell play 10 with those two? No, he doesn't. He's not playing well enough. You've got one of the three Celts. That's an argument for another day. You've got Bigger, Sexton or Russell. All have their supporters, all have their reasons. I mean, if Farrell does go, he's going to be very lucky, I think.
Because of the difference that Manu Tuilagi makes to the makeup of a midfield, is he a special case that Warren Gatland should pick him in the squad, even though he won't yet have played coming back from his Achilles injury? But by the time the Lions go, he could easily be part of a Sale title challenge. Do you have to put faith in him because of who he is?
Yeah, you do. But, you know, if you believe in faith, you go to church and find yourself very disappointed the world doesn't turn out like you think it should. He's just injured too often. Hard grounds of South Africa. At what stage do you say this is just a gamble too far? I know what you're saying, Alex. I think England have played their best rugby when he's been there, but he's not been there very often. If you look at the balance of being disappointed because of another injury, or you look at the balance of outstanding games, it tilts so far to the balance of disappointment that I think there comes a stage when you just think, if we could take 50 blokes on tour, fine, but you can't.
I still go back to the two England performances under Eddie Jones, you know, Dublin away, 2019, I think it was, and the World Cup semi-final. They would keep banging on about them, but you know, the common denominator was Manu Tuilagi. Actually, same move straight over the first line out, and you know, and set the tone straight away. And so I think he does go, just because, if I'm honest, I think it's a 9, 10, 12, 13 is a real conundrum for the Lions. You know, it's, I think at 12 and 13, of course, there's lots of different options, but not like there are in a huge number of other positions. So I think it's a challenge, and it's a challenge you could, that the coaches have got to get right. And I don't think they're quite there yet, because when you listen to Warren Gatland, he was saying, well, with my new coaching team that he's announced, you know, that there was quite a difference of opinion in terms of the squad. And who should be in that squad? Nine is another selection, you know, which is a, we know South Africa how strong they are in that position, but the Lions, it's by no means nailed on who goes in as a scrum half. I think with all the tens, including Farrell, they're all test match animals. They're clearly, you know, there's a form ladder, and Farrell's at the bottom of that form ladder, but he goes because he's a test match animal. And Gatlin will believe that if he surrounds him with good players, he'll be able to, you know, shake him out of the poor form that he's been in over a number of months. But yeah, I, to answer your question, I think Tuilagi does go because it's a risk worth taking. You know, South Africa is not New Zealand or Australia. If you do have to replace players, and let's face it, on recent tours that will happen. You know, it's an overnight flight, and you're straight into it. So yeah, Tuilagi goes for me.
Can we have first Alex? And then Lawrence, and then Stuart. Someone worth investing on as a real bolter. Someone possibly against the odds, but may sneak into the Lions team.
Well, it depends how you define that, because I, you know, would Manu Tuilagi count as a bolter, having not played for 7 months? Because I would be with Lawrence's camp. I'd pick him on the expectation of him gaining fitness and form over the next few weeks. So he would be mine, but there's a definition of a bolter that certainly wouldn't include a player of his stature. But given the circumstances, I'd certainly pick Manu in my 36. I think that narrow squad makes it really hard for any real left field selections, because there just isn't room.
Well, I think what people have to understand is that form is an important criteria for selection, and particularly Six Nations form is important, but it's not the only criteria. You know, this is going to be a tour like no other Lions tour's ever been like. You know, you've got to pick people who can really survive in this environment. Living in a bubble where you go and see a country, but you're not actually allowed to see the country. You know, the constraints around this touring party will be like no other. They may not even be allowed out their hotel for large chunks of time. So other than to see the back of a bus, the front of a bus, the inside of a stadium, barely the outside of the stadium, and then that's it, and then the team room. So you've got to pick people, you've got to pick personalities, you've got to pick characters, you've got to pick people that don't get homesick after 2 or 3 weeks. You know, this is a 7, 8, 9 week stint, you know, longer than any tour that these players will be used to going away on. The modern day professional goes away on a 2 or 3 week tour these days. You know, suddenly they're on a 9 week trip, and it's going to be different. So I don't know, this guy's not a bolter, but he, you know, you underestimate the basics of the game against South Africa at your peril. If you don't get this right, if you don't get the scrum and line out right, you have got no game against South Africa. And we know that they are strong at scrum and they are strong in the line out. So for me, he's not playing international rugby at the moment by his own choice, but Joe Marler has to go on the Lions tour. He's probably up there as one of the top five scrummagers in the world right now, particularly at Loosehead. I think he is a character that has his own struggles, but actually I think he would be good value for the Lions. His destruction of London Irish's scrum won them the game. Marcus Smith grabbed the headlines, of course, and rightly so, for scoring that try. But Joe Marler is playing outstandingly well. He's a great ball carrier, very strong defensively, and importantly, he's a really good scrummager. And I think he has to go for me. He is my Lions bolter.
Very good one. Stuart?
Can I have a bloke who's a bolter not to go on tour, but to just, in the last few weeks, has just played his way as a starter certainty into the test team? We didn't have a clue about scrum half. We had what we thought were fading scrum halves and not good enough scrum halves. Since the last two rounds of the Six Nations, especially the England game, Conor Murray has found his form. He was very good for Munster against Leinster. He's got no opposition. So Conor Murray, from being if he gets his form back, he could be the number nine, has become my inked in number nine, one of the absolute certainties to start the test series now.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Alex, you were at Stonex Stadium yesterday. I thought it would be a lot closer than that, but obviously it wasn't. What sort of shape did Saracens and also Ealing Trailfinders, what shape were they in?
Yeah, so I thought it would be a little closer. And in the opening exchanges, Ealing won, I think, a free kick and two penalties off the Saracens scrum. And the Saracens starting front row was Jamie George, Vincent Koch and Mako Vunipola. I thought, here we go. And then they just turned on the power. Saracens, every avenue that Ealing tried to attack down, they just ran into a wall of defenders. It was a very Saracens-like performance in defence, just swarming Ealing, really giving nothing. Owen Farrell played very well, and he combined beautifully with Elliot Daly, who was loving life outside centre. They got into cruise mode, really, and pulled away from Ealing, who scored a lovely try towards the end, but the game was gone by then. I thought it was a mark in the sand from Saracens, who had been chasing the league since losing that first game. They knew that if they beat Ealing at home, they'd be straight back in the promotion race. And afterwards, Mark McCall talked of Ealing as a mid-table Premiership side in quality. I think he was being generous there. He made that point largely because he was being asked about the Saracens Lions contingent, and he was arguing that actually they are playing competitive rugby. And if they get to the final, they'll have the two-legged playoff compared to the Celtic players in the Rainbow Cup who aren't really playing any meaningful rugby. He was trying to argue the case for his players. They will be ready for the Lions tour. And in that context, he put Ealing as a mid-table Premiership team. But I think they're some way short of that. I think teams like Newcastle and Leicester and Northampton would argue quite strongly that Ealing aren't that good.
Just on that, by the way, I think Gatland's already said that there's going to be some big names that will miss out on selection. And I think he was looking more towards England than most other teams. You can pick one or two players who are out of form and know that, in the right environment, you can bring them back to where they belong. But you can't pick too many players. And Eddie Jones has already made that mistake. And I'm pretty sure Gatland won't make that mistake. So I'd say that Elliot Daly and Billy Vunipola are in serious doubt. And people like Farrell, Itoji and George have got credit in the bank. So there is some interesting selections there for Gatland, for sure.
I think the problem that those players have, Lawrence, is that playing well, even against the second best team in the Championship, doesn't prove enough. Elliot Daly found space.
But Wales have got a model where once they bring their players in camp, I mean, Wales don't perform in the Champions Cup. And yet, they at international level, they're able to perform. So Gatland, along with Paul Stridgen, the fitness coach, has got a formula where he can coax the best. He can get those players up to where they need to be, both physically and mentally, to perform. So I'm not concerned. We have a go at our players when they don't perform, but all the Welsh squad players, they don't play brilliantly in the big games for their clubs, and yet they're able to play brilliantly for their country. So I don't think it's. You always have to follow the same formula. And Gatland knows how to get the best out of players, particularly in physically and more importantly, mentally as well.
Yeah, no, I agree. All I meant was if you are an Elliot Daly or a Billy Vunipola and you're trying to earn a spot, it's harder to do it because a good performance against Ealing or Ampthill doesn't carry the same weight.
Stuart, just a final say. We know that Eddie Jones is very sniffy towards Premiership, probably too sniffy because he uses it as an excuse. But we've already spoken this morning about Saracens coming back. We know that Leicester and Northampton are at least on their way. Quins and London Irish were very close on the weekend. Are we looking possibly to next season, one of the most powerful Premierships? Because it looks to me like a lot of the clubs are now improving.
Well, they are, Steve, but I think they're improving from a pretty low base. Take Exeter and Saracens out of the equation, and the reality is we've fallen a long way behind the French League. Our standards have been low. It's entertaining, it's exciting, and one of the reasons is, I think, belatedly, we're working on things like offloading. We're working on our support lines. And it's not just one great big dog turd of breakdown after breakdown, which the Premiership had become. There are less rucks. It is a speedier game. A speedier game makes it a little bit nearer to being international in its intensity. I have not much sympathy for Eddie Jones about much, but I actually think he's right when you look at the Premiership and Jones says there's a massive difference. I believe there is. I still think Bristol are a highlights package team. They're lovely to watch, but I think Exeter are miles clear this year as the only English team anywhere near an international intensity. So I have a bit of sympathy for Eddie Jones, but I do think that the Premiership is showing great signs of improvement. But, you know, there's still, you know, there's ambition, but where there's ambition, there's not always accuracy. It makes for thrilling rugby, but not test match rugby yet.
Lawrence, I've loved the last few weeks of the Premiership. Is Stuart, is that fair enough for Stuart, or do you think there's something a little bit more serious happening there?
There are a lot of people that kind of quite like the problems that Saracens are going through, but actually, I think they're a huge loss to the Premiership, you know, in terms of their quality. I mean, when you've got half the international team not playing in the Premiership, you know, and some of the biggest stars of the game in this country, it is a huge loss. So, you know, the sooner they get back to where they belong, the better, really, quite frankly. So I think that's one for sure, because I think they are up there. I think with Bristol, I don't think anyone would, and Pat Lamb would say that they're not the finished article. They've come a long, long way in a relatively short space of time. They've won a trophy and they're getting better. You know, they've got stardust in their team. They've got some players that week in, week out are really playing very, very well. So I think they're on a journey. I hate using that word, but they are on a journey. But it's an upward curve, and I think they will get better. But I do agree with Barnsley that they have got a way to go, and that game at the weekend just reminded everyone that, you know, that there's certain ways to win, you know, high intensity games of rugby, and there's a naivety still with Bristol in terms of the way that they play. But it's a beautiful naivety, because when you've got people like Charles Piatow in your team, why shouldn't you have the confidence to run out of your own 22 and score a try, which is exactly what they did. But the problem is, in the big games, you've got to select when to do that and when not to. And I think Bristol too often select, you know, the wrong options, particularly against good sides that just shut them down. So, yeah, look, there is a lot to behold in the Premiership, but I'm still confused with the English club model. Even after 26 years of professional rugby, can't quite work out what everyone's trying to do, because you've got 12 teams. Don't think there's enough quality spread. I mean, I think the quality spread too thinly, if I'm honest. I'd love a radical draft pick, you know, or a draft system in club rugby where we could make sure that the quality spread out across the league. There's talk about the Premiership moving to 14 teams in the near future, never mind the ESL. I think rugby's got, you know, drifting into problems of its own around promotion and relegation. I still can't understand how they think they can have 24 rounds of Premiership games, 9 weekends of European rugby, and 10 test matches in the same calendar year, and expect to get the best out of our players. So I think there's still a lot of head scratching for the Premiership to do. I think the communications, as been mentioned earlier on, is at an all-time low. The relationship between the clubs and its principal partner, I don't think it's ever been as bad. In the words of Chris Jones, our, you know, guest on the Ruck, PRL's kind of messaging is, don't tell anyone about anything, no matter how important it is. So I think the Premiership's got a long way to go. But if you've got the right people around the table, I think it could get there a lot quicker than it has in the last 12 months, that's for sure.
Alex, we'll put you on the spot. If you succeeded the man who never was, and went into and took charge, where would you be looking? 14 clubs, the end of relegation, or would you enshrine relegation? What was your personal shape of the league?
That's an enormous question, and it's something I was just thinking about there.
You're an enormous authority.
Well, yeah, I'm trying to get slightly slimmer, but your point about next season being, you know, the most powerful. I think the decision that gets made about promotion and relegation for next season will have a massive impact on that. if relegation comes back next season, you have those, you have all 13 teams in the league, then you have the bottom third fighting for safety. There'll be a jeopardy there, and you won't have teams cruising from mid-season as we've had this season. And I understand, and I was behind the reason for ring fencing this season. I understood it. I think that's a massive policy decision that the Premiership have to come to. My personal view is I think having a conference system, splitting it into two, having fewer matches, but making each match an event is massive. I think there are too many Premiership games that drift by and no one pays any attention, that they don't mean enough. You have to create, and this is where the CVC influence comes in, and it borrows from other sports around the world, American football, for example. You have to make each game an event. You know, there has to be a rarity factor that drives people into the stadiums, that demands people watch it on television. And as Lawrence says, there are so many games that you can just pick up highlights and you can move on. It's a bit like one day cricket or 2020 cricket. There's so much of it that there's no appointment to view. And I think that's where the club game really needs to stop and look at its structure. Whether it's two conferences of seven and then a playoff system, thought process I would bring in if I took over at Premiership Rugby would be to create big events, engage the public much better in stadium than they do now. The screens aren't good enough, for example. Every fan should be given a ref link on the way in so they understand what's happening, because the television coverage, as Lawrence knows because he's part of it, is so good. Television coverage is so good that there's an argument that you get a better experience watching it from home. And the club game needs to fight against that. They need to drive people back into the ground, drive people to watch on television. And that means creating an appointment to view product, and having too many games works against that.
Don't keep saying this thing about not going to the games, because there'll be accountants on the sixth floor listening to this podcast. They might ask us to do everything at home. Okay, that's the end of a great chat about the Premiership and a little bit more stick for the man who never was, Darren Charles. I don't think I think all of you were working elsewhere on the weekend, lads. There was England took the Grand Slam against France at the Stoop, their third championship on the trot, a very tight game in what has actually been a woefully one-sided series of matches. I just wonder what you thought, what they do now. It's very easy to follow the Six Nations model, keep the same six teams. But is it any good if you know you're going to win a game and you were almost certainly bound to win it by more than 50 points, which when the two professional sides play the others is almost a guarantee?
It's self-defeating for the other teams who get hammered. They're better off playing each other than having a lower level, lower quality league until they build their games. England and France are better playing off each other in an epic series every year. That's not to say in 5 years' time that Wales or Ireland may have risen or England and France may have fallen. But at the moment, it just seems pointless. And I know we all want to think the best of it, but it's not a great tournament because England and France are so far clear.
Lawrence, is that fair enough? There's no point in keeping the old structure if it's going to be an embarrassment.
We've tried to follow the Six Nations, which is understandable, but the chasm of quality between, you know, England and France and the rest is just too big, too great. So there's no reason why the women's game needs to follow the men's game in terms of its structure. They've got the opportunity. The game is not, you know, is not necessarily big enough yet, but it is. We have to listen to what people are wanting. You know, it's the fastest growing sport, women's rugby, in the world. You know, the participation levels across the world are going up massively. So, you know, it's here. You know, let's grow it in the right way. You know, England have this crazy situation where they've just won the Six Nations title against France. And who are they playing next week? France, in a friendly. So, albeit a different challenge for them, because they've got to go to France to play them. So, yeah, look, we're going to get back to that club v country argument. Who owns the women's game? Is it international rugby or is it club rugby? You know, and I know that WASF, you know, are very keen to invest much more money in the women's team. Our current wage bill is £150,000, so there is a big gap, and someone needs to invest in that gap. It's going to be fascinating to see what direction of, you know, it goes over the next few years.
And some personal thoughts. First of all, there were three games on the final day. All of them were relatively close, which was good. And the final order was England, France, followed by Ireland, Italy, Wales. Sorry, Ireland, Italy, Scotland, and Wales. And you could tell the cavernous gap because actually Wales in the third game scored their first points of any sort against Scotland. At least they were pretty competitive, but it's now split really into three divisions, and with only six teams, that is a struggle. It's very difficult for England and France to play at their best when they've been beating teams by 50 points. You get into bad habits. So it was a showpiece occasion, but it wasn't a showpiece game. In my opinion, this England side has got a lot of promise. Helena Rowland seems to be settling in at fly half, but they are categorically not yet in the same class as the 2014 team, which won the title, nor are they in the same class remotely as the 2017 team, which lost in the final to New Zealand. So they've got a long road to travel, and they are now in desperate need of real tough fixtures.
Steve, you've covered women's rugby for decades. It feels to me, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on it, that the sport has now reached a point where it's strong enough to break out on its own. It doesn't have to live in the shadow of the men's sport. So, for example, when the Lions announced a feasibility study into a women's Lions team, and there was conversations, you know, oh, maybe there could be a joint tour of Australia in 2025. And I'm thinking, well, why would the women's Lions team want to go to Australia? Because the power tour there would be to go to North America or to tour France.
Absolutely. I think they've had. I think you're right, and they've had enough of being told what they should be doing by sort of middle-aged blokes wearing blazers. I think they just want to do it on their own, and they're quite right, because maybe they could even come up with something that the men's game could copy. It's ridiculous following everybody, and they now need some administrators, women administrators and coaches, to come through strongly to give them their own voice. It's about time they were not completely held sheltering under the men's umbrella. It's as simple as that. And incidentally, on the boom in players, there's a colossal boom at Maidenhead, where I believe that the fine level of coaching is attracting women from all over the south of England. We now move on to the highlights of the week, our god or goddess of the week. We'll start with you, Alex, please.
I can't look any. I mean, I was looking through the... I watched the England women's game. I know Sarah Hunter didn't play as much as she would have liked, but she's an extraordinary captain. But my pick would be Zoe Allcroft, player of the match in the final. I thought she'd had a really superb championship. So she's my pick for Goddess of the Week.
Queen Zoe is the start. Lawrence?
Well, there's so many to choose from. I mean, you've got the performance of, you know, individual brilliance of Louis Rees-Zammit. I thought Sam Simmons, Slade and Jack Noel could easily be up there in terms of their performances. Dan Bigger, as Barnsley's mentioned, heroically courageous, but there is only one choice really for the God of the Week. He was the sports writer since 2003 when he graduated from the Press Association training scheme. He spent 2 years working in Australia, but he's now the deputy rugby correspondent for the Times, and my God of the Week for his outstanding work, clocking in and then clocking out, clocking in on a Monday and clocking out only last night. The God of the Week is Alex Lowe.
There are very few people who would disagree with that, really, honestly. When your closest colleague buzzes off and is not seen for 6 weeks, someone has got to pull in the slack. Stuart?
Well, I am known to pray at the Church of Lowe. I don't deny that, but I'm going to blaspheme and I'm going to go for Bigger, the man who put others ahead of himself in this age of ego. Dan Bigger is my God of the Week.
Very good, very good. I think, actually, I'm going to discard all my options because they don't measure up in any way to Lawrence's choice. And I think for the first time, the goddess of the week is Alex Lowe, one of our very own. Why shouldn't we? I mean, the RFU review themselves and mark themselves, so why shouldn't we honour our own?
I'm not happy about something. I want to be transparent on the Alex Lowe thing.
Okay. In any difficult choice, there are always dissenters. Stuart, have you got a problem with having Alex Arthur Lowe as Goddess of the Week?
Well, I have, Steve, because I'd like to follow in the RFU's footsteps and maintain a degree of transparency. I don't want anyone to know what I've been saying. In fact, I'd like my voice to be muffled so they don't know I suggested Dan Bigger.
Right, okay, that's fair enough. So you want to stay a shadowy figure?
Anonymous, yes, yes.
Anonymous, okay. Well, that was Stuart Barnes there, just being anonymous. Chaps, just one more point about how on-the-spot and informed we are. This morning I listened to part of another podcast where some clown talking on it was described as having his finger on the spot and reporting from the heart of the game. I'd never, ever seen him before or heard of him. So don't forget, matches these days are attended by no one except a few hardened journalists and broadcasters, and only a few of us are invited onto major Zoom press conferences. This is practically the only pod where panellists have actually been at the game and talked to the key people. So when you hear unknown saying they're the only men on the spot, you should treat them with the derision they deserve. They are guessing what is really happening, and our panel today was telling you, with our fingers on the temperature, what did happen. Thank you.
One-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
ACAST powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.